This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's almost expected that the first draft of history will frame women like Lorena Bobbitt, now Gallo, as reckless, careless, violent, stupid, and slutty. Just like Pamela Smart.
According to police, Pamela Smart convinced her teenage lover to murder her husband.
Now, Pamela Smart offering to pay each teenager $1,000 for the murder of her husband.
Or notorious vixen 17-year-old Amy Fisher.
She is accused of an affair with a married man more than twice her age. She is in jail on charges of trying to kill his wife.
Or the quintessential gold digger, Anna Nicole Smith.
She married an 89-year-old Texas billionaire when she was just 26. And within months, she was in court fighting his son for a share of the dead oil man's estate.
From the view out here in 2021, these women's stories were profitably twisted by tabloid media and lampooned by late-night TV hosts in ways utterly devoid of context, much less empathy. Because these stories were nothing like they seemed. Enter the hosts of the You're Wrong About podcast, who I spoke to in February. Since 2018, Sarah Marshall and Michael Hobbs have been exploding the myths that have taken residence in the back rooms of our minds, maybe briefly, maybe forever. Myths about people so overexposed, so processed, that it seemed as if there was nothing left to tell. But in fact, there was everything to tell about them and about America and its media. Then and now.
There's dozens, hundreds of these stories that kind of live in your head in these weird fragments. We don't realize the degree to which we're filling in the blanks in our head, right? So you hear about somebody like Amy Fisher who, you know, shot this other woman. Wasn't she some sort of teenage seductress? And like, that's kind of just living in my head as almost like a meta narrative. But I'm filling in all the blanks. Like, I couldn't tell you the sort of...
The Massapequa Mary Magdalene. No, that's not it. It's something like that.
And so you're like, well, you know, she seems like a terrible person, but you haven't really given it that much thought.
And you're telling the stories to each other. And the one who isn't telling the story is vital to the project because they're observing for the rest of us. You make a point of not knowing much about what the other person is about to tell you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've been interrupting my boyfriend for the last year every time he brings up JonBenet Ramsey. He's like, oh, that reminds me of the time that they found. And I'm like, don't tell me anything because I know Sarah is eventually going to tell me all about JonBenet Ramsey. And I want to preserve that in my head as sort of these little bips and bobs of a story that I really don't have the details of. And one of us does a ton of research and walks the other one through. And we try to make it sort of normal to come in with false understandings of these stories, basing our understandings on the information that we had at the time. And oftentimes it was just really bad.
You mentioned research, but you're not interested in obtaining new documents or exclusive interviews. You're interrogating the public record, reading books that have already been written, poring over old news articles. Is it about the real story that was hiding in plain sight?
For me, it often is. And I think I am a historian who is frequently mistaken for a journalist. The joy of this show is that I get to do stories that pretty much it was hard for me to be able to write about, because if you're going to talk about something that happened in recent history, often it will have to be because you have found some new exciting piece of information or because there's a timely peg. So I would like wait for the anniversaries to click around and be like, this is my year for a Tonya Harding piece. I'm going to seize the moment. And with this, I love the chance to not have to make up an excuse to just talk about not just getting to the bottom of who this person was, but trying to more deeply understand who we were when we did what we did to them. Part of the joy of doing this show is that we have the same protagonist in every episode, which is us, the people who make and consume the tabloid stories that, you know, if you are trying to pretend you're not interested in a story, then that means you're interested in it. That's not the same thing as indifference. We get to look at ourselves and the choices that we have made.
It's also really shocking how easily findable the correct information was then and now. I mean, to just pick one example, one of the most radicalizing episodes that I've done of the show was the Terri Schiavo case, mm-hmm. in which there was this woman who was in a persistent vegetative state, and her husband was trying to end her life, and her parents, who were conservative Christians, were trying to save her. And I thought going in, it was going to be this like very murky issue of, you know, bioethics and who can say when life begins and ends, and this very difficult sort of issue to untangle. And then you start looking at the actual documents, and it turns out that every single independent doctor who examined Terri Schiavo said that she was completely brain dead. There were no electrical impulses in her brain whatsoever, that she had received excellent care from her husband. He actually quit his job and went to nursing school so that he could provide her with better care. And there was no chance of recovery. So a pretty straightforward story of a husband doing what he really thought was best for his wife, and all of the information was on his side. And yet when that was presented to the public, it was seen as a sort of, well, both sides have really good arguments, and isn't it true, Michael Schiavo, that you haven't been giving your wife this great care? The information was there, like, there are court documents, but it appears that people just didn't present that information to the public at the time. It's incredible.
Telling a story chronologically really does seem to be key.
Because so many of these sort of moral panics and maligned women come to us as these fully formed figures. And we don't get all of the factors that brought them to that situation until much later, right? We're kind of doing it in this like memento order every time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the reasons 90s scandals about maligned women are so interesting is that this is the era of the 2-month true crime book. Amy Fisher had 3 TV movies made about her that aired roughly simultaneously. 2 of them were on the same night.
That was amazing.
Yeah, and there was this idea at the time, I think people had, that if you were the subject of all this attention, you must be profiting. You had to be deriving some kind of benefit from that. It couldn't just be more trauma heaped on top of the trauma that had already brought you to that degree of fame. And it has been really hard in these stories for us as a public to get past the idea that if someone is the subject of all this attention, they must have won in some capacity. The person at the center rarely is heard, certainly in these 90s stories. And Amy Fisher was ordered by her lawyer to not talk and present her story to the public. And because of that, she was the only person who wasn't able to tell the public who she was.
In the Anna Nicole Smith episode, you observed that we were focused on her having all the power that Amy Fisher was assumed to have derived from her notoriety. In the case of Anna Nicole Smith, it was like her breasts were worth $500 million, leaving no agency for her elderly husband. But what all these tabloid women seem to have in common when they are perceived to have power, it's almost always through sex.
Mm.
And it turns out, if you dig into their story, it's about other people's exploitation of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's very scary to the people who write these stories that these women have any power at all.
Yeah. And I think this idea that a girl can grow up with nothing and decide to provide for herself and her child by exploiting her own sexuality, I mean, I just will leave it with the paradox that we're fine with exploiting women's sexuality if it's like a man or a corporation doing it. But if the woman is exploiting her own sexuality or profiting off of herself, declaring her own value, that's where we draw the line.
This episode hasn't aired yet, so Sarah, maybe do earmuffs. But another really good example of that is Vanessa Williams, who famously was the first Black Miss America and was the first Miss America to relinquish her crown because she took a bunch of nude photographs the summer before she became Miss America. She wanted to become an actress. She was obsessed with Meryl Streep. She thought that modeling was a way that she could get into being an actress. She meets a photographer. She ends up working for him for a couple months as his receptionist. They become close. One night he says, "Hey, have you ever tried nudes? There's a sort of photographic technique that I want to try with silhouettes. So we're not going to be able to see your face. It's just going to be shapes. Why don't I take a couple photos? I'm never going to release them. It's just me testing this stuff out. Don't worry about it." And she says, "Yeah, sure. I trust this guy. No big deal." To me, that is very legible as a human story. You know, you do something for somebody else because they ask you to, and it would be a little bit awkward if you said no. Then she becomes Miss America, and he's hard up for cash, and he sells the photos. Most Americans learned that story in this inverted pyramid way as the next issue of Penthouse is going to have Miss America in it. When you learn it in that order, it's like, well, she must be getting paid, and this is her way of cashing in on her fame. And that became the story. The people who actually did cash in on this were the photographer and, of course, the publisher of Penthouse. She got nothing, but she was cast as somebody who had all of the power in this situation.
Why have you chosen to tell or retell the stories that you tell? What makes a perfect story for your show?
Our stories often break down to a few archetypes, and we often will see people, regardless of their individuality, regardless of the setting, regardless of the moment, acting in basically the same way and making the same mistakes and receiving the same warnings as in a lot of other stories that we've already told. Humans do the same things over and over. When you see them all in a row, it's just staggering. And I think the two most obvious categories that I can name there are the maligned woman and the moral panic.
And it is remarkable how often abuse lies at the opening chapter of so many of these stories.
I have been surprised at how central abuse, especially domestic abuse, has been to the stories that we've looked into. We haven't talked yet about our now 15-episode series on the O.J. Simpson trial. Mm-hmm. I remember when that was going on, that, you know, you would hear these stories in kind of like this weird hectoring tone of like, well, nobody's talking about Nicole Brown Simpson and, you know, the victim has been lost and all of this. But yet they didn't really do anything to correct that. They would just sort of scold their audience and then move on with covering the trial. And so what Sarah did, what we did in those episodes, was just start with the story of Nicole before we got to the murders. And that's, I think, best understood as a story of also escalating domestic violence. And it makes perfect sense when you hear it in that order and from her perspective. It's like, oh, it all falls into place. There was also, I think, a lot of shooting the messenger back then.
Yes.
That I think a lot of the information, especially about Nicole Brown Simpson, was coming from her friends. And a lot of her friends are, you know, Beverly Hills housewives, and they seem a little bit tacky to people. And most of the people writing book reviews at the time, most of the coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial was being done by men.
And so Faye Resnick has an ostentatious bathroom, no one has to take seriously what she says about how horribly her friend Nicole was being abused by her ex-husband.
We find over and over again, especially in the 80s and the 90s, that the worst thing you could do was be tacky. Maybe you have shoulder pads or maybe you have big hair. I mean, so much of this comes back to these really aesthetic judgments that were 99% being made by men. You know, certain voices, certain people just weren't in the media, weren't represented because, like, they just seemed a little bit cheap.
And so you think that in recent years, the media, having been democratized to a degree, has gotten more open to different perspectives?
As a tacky person myself, I think that tacky people have more of a platform today. And I think that people just have the opportunity to gravitate toward the kind of outlooks that resonate with the way they see the world. And also, I think a lot about the fact that I, as a millennial woman, tried to figure out what being a girl in America was about, learning that by watching the examples of girls who were ruthlessly profited off of and then basically destroyed. You know, the idea, just you make all the money you can off of someone and then, you know, the last profitable thing they can do is die. You know, you don't hope that that happens, but it never seems like anyone's trying to prevent that outcome either in these stories. And I think mm-hmm. there's something very humbling about being now a fully baked adult in a world where younger people, in a way that I couldn't at the time, are able to gain a lot of traction just by saying online, going on TikTok or something and saying, like, this is ridiculous. Like, the media is trying to sell this person as a predator to me, and I see them as a victim. This girl has no power, and I know because I'm a girl with no power. Looking back at the times that perhaps you collaborated with that media apparatus, maybe you would have been more empathetic if you had heard someone field an empathetic perspective first, but you didn't.
You know, we're in the middle of the societal moment where we are revisiting a lot of these stories of Lorena Bobbitt and Britney Spears, and we're going back around. And I think that that is great, but I also think that one of the dangers of that approach is that you can go from casting them as these malign figures who were these avaricious, sex-obsessed teenage girls to retelling mm-hmm. those stories as, like, they're not devils, they're actually angels. Mm-hmm. If we give them this sort of pop sainthood,
yeah.
I don't think that's the solution. I think no. the solution is to always keep in mind it's simply more complicated. Right. We just did a 5-part series on Princess Diana, and one of the things we spent a lot of time on was that, you know, she was a very difficult person to live with, and she also, at one point, pushed her elderly stepmother down the stairs. That's a really bad thing. And, like, we didn't defend it. We didn't minimize it. We're just like, we're just going to give that to you and let you sit with it.
Mm-hmm. Brian Stevenson, the civil rights lawyer who created the lynching museum in Montgomery, Alabama, says we are not the worst thing we've ever done. Mm-hmm. I guess it means that no one is beyond redemption. Mm. I know that you guys say you don't identify as an empathy project, but as a humanizing project. Mm. Mm.
Maybe it's worth thinking about the idea of human rights in the media. The essential goal is to try to make space for someone's humanity to be present. People came away from our Princess Diana episodes really not liking her. Not that many people, but some people. Some people were like, no, I hate her because she pushed that old lady down the stairs. And, like, that's where the line is for some people. Then the question is, do you believe that someone has the right to not be harassed by paparazzi, to receive humane treatment and human consideration, even if you don't like them? And I think the answer has to be yes.
Yeah. One of the most difficult concepts, I think, for the American public and the American media to deal with is proportionality.
Yes.
Did Monica Lewinsky behave, like, super-duper responsibly when she was an intern and had a crush on her boss and sort of approached Bill Clinton? Like, no, and she would be the first person to admit that. But also, does that pretty common youthful mistake mean that she should, like, never be able to work again, and she should be bullied by the entire country and all these late night jokes? So much of the project is to sort of demystify what people's actual mistakes were. Hmm. Oftentimes, like, they are real mistakes, they are real bad decisions, but oftentimes we find that women and minorities are way over punished for those mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Your show is also about what Americans are willing to believe, but it's very, very hard to uproot a lie. Mm-hmm. So in making this show, have you learned anything about how to effectively overturn wrong-headed myths?
I don't think you can take something away from someone if it's a narrative that is making them feel the way that they need to feel about who they are or the society they live in without offering them something to then take its place. My realization that things are not just bad, things are really bad, like everything you know is a lie bad, was when I interned at the Georgia Innocence Project in the summer of 2016. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, our legal system is in trouble. I know I've been told that, but no, it's really in trouble. And what I think allowed me to accept having that deep faith in the American system and American law that I didn't even know that I had, changing their mind about something that they assumed was one way when they were younger. Because I think when you are given the opportunity to step up and to accept this humbling experience of admitting that you had been wrong, you had been tricked, but you had been tricked because someone tried to trick you, often because it would sell more copies of something. If you can accept that humbling when people are seizing the first opportunity to denigrate someone, you can be the person who knows that that might not be the truth and speak on behalf of greater nuance and try and complicate the conversation. It doesn't make you having to interject about that not annoying, but the right people will not be annoyed by you. There are a lot of them.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brooke. It's such a treat.
Such a treat, yeah. We got to stop saying the same stuff at the same time. It's embarrassing.
Sorry. Sarah Marshall and Michael Hobbs are hosts of the podcast You're Wrong About. On the Media is produced by Leah Feder, Micah Lowinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark-Callender, and Molly Schwartz, with help from Ellen Lee. Zandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Our engineers this week were Adrian Lilly and Sam Baer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.